As concerns over the long-term viability of coal and oil continue to mount, some argue that natural gas is the next best investment in energy. But our guest this hour says natural gas is just as unsustainable and, if relied upon, would have lasting impacts on our wallets and our economy. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the author of the book, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth, during this hour, and we will welcome your questions for him and your views as well. Do you have concerns, as our guest does, about relying on natural gas for energy? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Bill Powers is a private investor and energy analyst and author of Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark. He also sits on the board of directors of Arsenal Energy. Hello, thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, so we have heard a lot about the 100-year supply of natural gas. You're saying that that natural gas is not that plentiful?
That's correct. The propaganda that has been put out by the industry, media, as well as the government and academia is grossly misleading when it comes to the importance of shale gas. And shale gas has been around for quite some time. It goes all the way back to the early days in the 1820s when the first gas well was in the United States was drilled in Fredonia, New York, along the shores of Lake Erie. And what we're seeing now is the modern shale gas industry really kicked off about 12 years ago with the commercialization of the Barnett Shale in Texas through horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing has really come into the fore, and it's opened up a lot of new resources. However, these resources are nowhere near as large and as plentiful, nor are they as cheap to extract as has been previously put out by many observers of the energy industry. And I think this is so what this has encouraged is a setup of where we are now consuming a record amount of natural gas, and we are on the verge of a significant supply shortage that will lead to a 1970-style gas crisis. And I detail all of this in my book.
And tell us what you mean by the title of your book, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark.
Well, the book is goes all the way back to the early. The first part of the book is a quick read through the 1970 style gas crisis, and what happened at that time is we had record growth in production right after World War II, where many of the big fields in Texas and Louisiana were connected to manufacturing centers in Chicago and elsewhere through long pipelines. We saw gas stay very cheap for several decades. And what this encouraged was the building of natural gas-fired power plants throughout the 1960s, getting away from coal, converting industrial boilers from fuel oil to natural gas. And by the early 1970s, demand was outstripping supply. And despite record production, production peaked in about 1972, and it wasn't surpassed until just recently. But what we saw was a 12-fold increase in prices between 1971 and 1984. And production went down 20%. And so what had happened is there were several hundred coal-fired power plants that were built to reduce demand from the electricity generating sector. There were several dozen nuclear power plants that came online. In 1978, President Carter signed a law that encouraged manufacturers to convert their boilers away from natural gas to back to fuel oil. They outlawed the building of new natural gas-fired power plants. And during this period, we saw an increase in food prices because a lot of the cost of food is based on natural gas fertilizers. We saw home heating prices rise. We saw the price of electricity go through the roof. And we saw many people lose their jobs because a lot of manufacturing had to close because of lack of natural gas supply. So this is a scenario that is likely to repeat itself in the relatively near future.
I thought that natural gas was just a part of our energy mix, and it was one way to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Isn't it just a part of many different energy sources for us?
Correct, and that is true. We obviously consume coal and oil. I mean, we produce the equivalent of 10 million barrels on an energy equivalent basis of natural gas per day here in the United States, and we are the world's largest producer, but we are still not self-sufficient. We consume more natural gas than any other country on Earth. We are a net importer of natural gas, and so what is difficult is finding substitutes for natural gas when supplies run short, and we saw this happen in the early 1970s. Is that it's very difficult when demand for electricity is high to kill demand, and the only way to do that is through higher prices. And what happened in the 1970s that I think is very important is that we didn't drill our way out of the 1970s crisis, even though we saw a 12-fold increase in wellhead prices. We destroyed demand. We destroyed our natural gas demand by 20%, and this required us to go back to using more coal, which is something that I don't think a lot of people in the United States would be happy about. We are in the process of reducing our coal-fired power plants. A lot of them are closing. We've seen four nuclear power plants close in the United States this year. One of those is in Wisconsin. This is setting up for a heavier reliance on natural gas to generate electricity, and I think that this is really going to be headed, lead towards a lot of problems.
Yeah. So, can the bursting of this natural gas bubble be avoided?
It's too late now, in my opinion. There were many things that we could have done to avoid the gas pricing. The price of gas falling below the cost to produce it. I mean, shale gas is not cheap to produce. It requires around an $8 to $9 per 1,000 cubic foot price, and it's currently a little under $4 right now, so it'd have to double to get to just break even for most companies. And there was a lot of bad policies that were put in place that encouraged over-drilling. There were a lot of I would say bad investments by the industry, and there was a lot of expectations that I would say have misled many people to believing that it's cheap and it will be plentiful for years to come. And so we're now going to see the bursting of that bubble, and there's going to be a lot of pain. But in my book, I do talk about there's many, many ways to mitigate the coming gas crisis.
All right. So how do I mitigate the coming gas crisis?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I try to make very clear is that, the government in the 1970s, they made the situation worse through their policies. So the idea that the government will come and save you from the coming gas crisis is something that people should not believe in. What you can do, what homeowners can do, what people who maybe rent a home or rent an apartment, one of the things they can do is individually reduce their dependence on gas. And for homeowners, you can go to geothermal home heating systems almost anywhere throughout Wisconsin that's available. The price of solar generation has come down massively in the last 5 years due to the collapse in the price of polysilicon, as well as the efficiency of these panels has gone up. And whether you want to buy them, and nowadays you can even rent them, and you can get a rental bill that is less than your electricity bill every month. In most cases, this is, and to get further value out of any solar that you may install on your home, you can now go with energy storage, such as there are batteries that you can install in your home to store energy when during the sunniest parts of the day. You know, one of the things that that many communities are doing is, especially in California, are trying to set up cooperatives so they can set up either a solar array or a small wind farm and sell to their neighbors. We are on the verge of seeing a distributed power revolution in this country, and the incumbent utilities are really fighting this tooth and nail because they don't want homeowners to sell excess electricity into the grid and become their competitors. And so there's many things that we can do, you know, to mitigate our the coming crisis, but a lot of them are going to take some time, some planning, and money. But it starts with becoming aware that natural gas is not going to be cheap for much longer, and it's going to lead to a lot of distortions in the economy.
When do you think we're going to start seeing prices go up? When is this bubble going to burst?
Well, they're up 60% on a year-over-year basis since last year, I believe we are heading towards before the end of 2015, we will see the gas bubble burst, and we will go to world prices, which would be anywhere from $9 to $15, so between 3 and 5 times our current price.
And then we will be cold, hungry, and in the dark?
It depends on how well prepared you are, but there will be some people who will certainly be cold, hungry, and in the dark.
We are talking with the author of Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. He says that natural gas is not cheap and plentiful, and that by 2015 we're going to see energy prices going up, food prices going up, and says there are some ways that you can prepare. We welcome your thoughts and questions about this. Do you share his concerns about our reliance on natural gas? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Are you investing in other forms of alternative energy? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Bill Powers. He is the author of the book Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. We're talking about the reliance that we have on natural gas, and our guest saying that natural gas is just as unsustainable as coal and oil, and that it's the bubble is going to burst soon, and that could have a substantial effect on our economy and on our wallets. And we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Peter on Facebook says, the only long-term solutions to our energy needs look like science fiction right now, like solar powered satellites. That's the market that will create the first trillionaire, I think. Well, what do you think about that, Bill Powers?
Well, I don't know much about the satellite business, but I can tell you right now that putting solar panels on homes in California is at grid parity.
That mean?
That means that you are paying just as much, that the cost to install the solar panels generates enough, the cost to do that is the equivalent of what you would pay to your electric company every month, so that it is actually getting cheaper, and that is without a government subsidy. And I think the gentleman who asked that question hasn't been following the solar industry that closely for the last 5 years, because we've seen an enormous increase in inefficiency, as well as a huge drop in price. And this is continuing to move forward in this direction. And many homes throughout the country are headed towards, many areas of the country are headed towards grid parity with residential solar within the next 3 to 5 years. And this is something that you know, people should, you know, look into right now.
Well, so I guess on average, how much is it going to cost somebody in the Midwest to put solar panels on their house and help heat their home, you know, supply energy to their home, you know, instead of using natural gas?
Well, I mean, here again, that is on, it's on a case-by-case basis, but, you know, right now there's many companies that will rent you solar panels that will allow, and these companies that do this are able to do this and give you a rental agreement where your bill every month will be less than what you pay to the electric company, because these companies are able to collect tax credits for the renewable power that you generate from your home, as well as they are able to buy in bulk and have the installation done at a relatively low cost. So it varies, but right now there are parts of the country where it is very cost effective to do it, and I think throughout most of the country within the next 3 years, it will become very cost-effective.
Let's take a call from Chris in Evansville. Hello, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I have a question for the guest. Bill, I live in a two-story stucco home. It's older. I think it was built in 1912. I've always had fuel oil. I've lived there for 20 years, and fuel oil, of course, is very expensive. This fall, I've been planning to convert to natural gas, and now hearing what you're saying, I'm not sure that I should. It's going to cost me about $1,500 to convert to the natural gas. What's your recommendation for me?
What I would do is I would strongly recommend investigating a geothermal home heating system and cooling system, because right now, I was on a radio station last week in Connecticut, where there's a huge push to convert homes in Connecticut and elsewhere in New England from fuel oil to natural gas, and a lot of them are doing it. But I think, you know, for the short term, it may be very cost. It certainly will lower your bill, because the price of fuel oil is much higher than the price of natural gas. But you are going to have exposure to the price of natural gas over the life of that unit. And what I would recommend would be taking a hard look at geothermal, and, you know, whether if you're installing a new system, this is the time to look at it. Most homes, it can be installed very cost effectively. So I would, you know, consider your options. And if you really wanted to, since running a geothermal system does require electricity, now would be also a good time to maybe pair that with looking at installing a solar panel on your roof, if possible.
Yeah, what exactly is a geothermal system?
It's a closed loop system that has where it uses the earth's, where you have a system of tubes that run within a closed loop about 5 feet below the surface of the ground, where it stays a constant 55 degrees throughout the year, and it is basically a heat exchange system that in the winter can be used to heat the home, as well as in year-round it's able to heat hot water. And in the summer, it's able to cool the home, you know, by using the heat exchange technology. And these have been around for decades. There, you know, many cabins that are recreational cabins that are, you know, far from utilities use these, but they've become much more popular in the last decade as the efficiency has increased, the costs have come down, and there's significant subsidies that from both, I believe, the state and federal level that for people who are interested in installing these.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Bill Powers. He's a private investor and energy analyst, author of Cold, Hungry, and In the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. If you would like to join in with a question about energy sources and natural gas, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you support an investment in natural gas, and why or why not? Do you share our guests' concerns about relying on natural gas for energy? What do you think about his prediction of this impending, looming energy crisis, much like the 1970s? We welcome your input. Bill Powers, you also sit on the board of directors of Arsenal Energy. What exactly is that?
Sure. It's an oil and gas company based in Calgary, Alberta. We are active in the Bakken Shale of North Dakota, as well as Alberta and British Columbia. And we are a small company. We produce around 4,500 barrels a day of oil, and I've been very active in the company for 7 or 8 years now.
So you're involved with removing natural gas from the shale in North Dakota?
Well, most of the hydrocarbons we produce in North Dakota are is oil, and we do produce some gas in North Dakota, but it's predominantly oil. And most of what we produce in British Columbia is natural gas, and in Alberta, it's a mix.
Mm-hmm. So I did want to talk a little bit about the shale gas, and there's a lot of in Wisconsin we have a lot of frack sand mining going on, where the sand that is used in the fracking process to get the natural gas out of the rock is being mined here in Wisconsin. I talk some about why this is so controversial.
Well, if we look at why there's been such an uproar over gas, shale gas production, is that there's been a number of high-profile incidents that have really polluted and have caused some environmental damage. And unfortunately, these were largely, almost in every case, were largely preventable. These were where companies took shortcuts, or they used improper materials to drill and secure a well into a shale reservoir, and it's almost in every case was human error. And we've seen some cases where now that shale gas has moved into relatively more densely populated areas of Pennsylvania, and due to the nature of the geology in Pennsylvania, there's been quite a few incidents of methane migration into drinking water wells, and this is something that that both the state and industry is looking into, and it's really caused a lot of problems for a lot of the residents there, and I do think that this is an issue that will continue over the years, but it's something that that really needs to have some resources committed to find ways to do it more effectively and more safely.
Yeah. Well, why do you say our expectations of shale gas are unrealistic?
Okay. Well, firstly, there's been, and I have a whole section in the book on why we've gotten the overinflated view of shale gas, and if it starts, and I give examples of, and I have almost 600 footnotes in the book, so there's a lot of support for this. And if we look at, basically the industry wanted to promote this new resource or this. To attract investment from Wall Street, from foreign companies that were looking to get into U.S. shale gas business, so that they could turn around and sell their properties to foreign companies or U.S. companies that were latecomers to the shale gas business. And I've given numerous examples in the book, and this was even admitted by one of this strategy was even admitted to. At the depths of the financial crisis in 2008, by one of the CEOs of one of the largest shale gas producers in the United States, that this strategy is what was a course of action that they had been following. If we go to, I would say, just public policy, I know I am very critical of Boone Pickens in the book. He's made some outlandish claims about the size of the shale gas endowment. Publicly, he's put together the Pickens Plan, which has been out for 5 years now, and largely, you know, if we look, and he's used a lot of, he's collected a lot of money from a lot of private citizens. He's used patriotism on, you know, how we should replace oil and with natural gas for transportation purposes, and we're, you know, should not support the enemy by buying foreign oil. And but what really is his message? It is not that we should, you know, stop importing foreign oil. It's that we should pass the natural gas bill, which is a bill that gives tax breaks, incentives, grants to the natural gas vehicle industry, and more specifically for the installation of natural gas refueling stations. And it just so happens that Mr. Pickens is the largest shareholder of Clean Energy Fuels, and I talk about this extensively in the book, and he owns about 16 million shares of this company valued at over $200 million that will benefit greatly should the U.S. install natural gas refueling stations, which I have a whole chapter dedicated to natural gas vehicles and how they are a terrible idea.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, just briefly, because we have a lot of callers, why are natural gas vehicles so terrible, and why do you favor the electric vehicles over them?
Well, firstly, because it costs about $350,000 to install a refueling station versus between $1,000 and $20,000 for a electric vehicle station. We have about 1,000 refueling natural gas vehicle refueling stations available in the country. Very few are open to the public, whereas we have 5,000 EV refueling stations that are available. And you're basically trading one hydrocarbon problem for another, from oil to natural gas, whereas what's very exciting about electric vehicles is that they can be powered through renewable energy, such as there's GE is building solar carports, and so are several other companies to install to allow solar panels to power EV vehicles. But to finish up on where else we believe that the supply myth, the 100-year supply myth. If we, outside of Mr. Pickens, if we look at academia, there have been many studies that have been put out that have been supported by the industry that have given woefully unrealistic expectations of the recoverability of shale gas. And then finally, the U.S. government. The Energy Information Agency has put out numerous papers that had many factual errors that had no supporting evidence of their claims on the size of the shale gas endowment and the recoverability of shale gas, and I basically take this apart in detail in my book. And so,
yeah, let me bring some more callers in.
Sure.
Scott in Burlington is with us. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I just had a question for your caller as far as how does the entire natural gas industry have it wrong from suppliers to buyers to transporters when there is such a glut in capacity and pipeline capacity, the investment in building new pipelines from these plays. How does a whole entire industry have it so wrong and you're right?
Well, okay. I mean, if you look in the book, I mean, what are the claims they are making? And it is that, you know, if you look at the reserve write-downs that these companies have already taken have been enormous. And I'll give you one example. Chesapeake Energy, which is the largest producer of shale gas in the country, wrote off 20% of its reserves in the second quarter of last year. They should be writing off substantially more, but for changes that were done by the Securities and Exchange Commission, they're allowed to completely overstate their reserves. But more importantly, if you look at production history of shale plays, several of which are already in decline, the Barnett Shale is in decline. It's produced, and I detail all of this in my book. If we look at the size of the play, it's far lower than what was initially expected. We also are seeing each well recover about half as much as the industry has said. This is not my opinion. This is facts that were put out by the Texas Railroad Commission.
Can you let us know, though? I mean, it's sure. It's in your book, but what is? Why would the entire industry and government and media and everything else think that natural gas is a good way to go, and you're sure. The only one saying it's not?
And it's not just me. There's I mean, the geologist, I mean, the David Hughes, and I cite, as well as Art Berman, who wrote the foreword to my book. And I talk about exactly why they overstated. It's because they are selling something. In the case of industry, they are selling projects or their entire company to newcomers to the industry, and I give numerous examples of what a disaster it's been for foreign companies investing in the United States shale industry and the numerous write-downs they have taken. Media, if you look at, I'll give you a great example, they love getting advertising from the American Natural Gas Association and from some of the big players such as ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil owns the New York Times. As far as if you open up the New York Times, they used to talk about how we had a 100-year supply of gas right under our feet, you know, and now they basically, you know, take out tons of ads on how they give money to teachers, so the New York Times won't write critical articles of them. Academia. I give an example of how industry funded professors at Penn State University to write a very glowing piece of the Marcellus Shale, and the professors did not disclose that the money came from industry until a local group in Pennsylvania brought it to the dean of Penn State University, who then redacted the entire white paper and then reissued it with many changes and disclosure that that the funding did come from industry. We've also seen this at MIT. MIT has taken millions of dollars from the industry to write some white papers that are, in my opinion, woefully inaccurate.
Let me jump in because we're past our break time. We are talking with the author of Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth, Bill Powers. Bill Powers says there is a looming energy crisis. He says that our reliance on natural gas is unsustainable. He says declining productivity combined with increasing demand is going to cause prices to skyrocket, and that will damage the economy and have a profound effect on all of us. And we're welcoming your questions about the situation and what he recommends we do. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Bill Powers. He is the author of Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark. He is a private investor and energy analyst, and he sits on the board of directors of Arsenal Energy. Talking about our over-reliance on natural gas, saying that natural gas is not cheap and plentiful or as cheap and plentiful as we've been led to believe. And he is talking about the looming energy crisis that he sees coming. John in Madison is with us. Hello, John.
Hi. One of the talking points or one of the thrusts of the petrochemical industry at promoting natural gas is that natural gas produces between 50 and 75% less greenhouse gases compared to, depending on the coal used, to coal-fired utilities. And obviously, if you're right, the supply is limited. This is a disaster. But what does it say in terms of opportunity costs? As far as this country focusing in on the real renewables, the wind, the solar, the geothermal, the hydroelectric, et cetera, which are much more efficient than natural gas, what is this going to do to our country's striving in the really correct way to address global warming?
Well, I think it's a very good point. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think has really been problematic in this country is the how inefficient the grid is. We lose up to 77% of the energy that it comes that comes in through either coal, hydroelectric, or water in the case of hydroelectric plants, uranium in the case of nuclear plants, or natural gas in the case of natural gas-fired power plants, between the point of electricity generation and the point of consumption. And between 10 and 12% of this happens through line loss, as well as many other inefficiencies. So just by making the grid more efficient, there's an incredible amount of low-hanging fruit that we can harvest without building more plants, and without expanding the grid, without building more power lines. And I think really where we should be focusing on is distributed power, where households and communities focus on ways to generate as much of their own electricity as possible so we can avoid the line loss. And this, I think, people will find is not only cheaper in many cases, it doesn't expose you to the wild swings and natural gas prices, or in the case of the guest or the caller from earlier, fuel oil prices, who is now really paying a high price to heat her home that's heated by fuel oil. And so, you know, by becoming more robust and having a more robust energy system in this country, in my opinion, is really the way forward, and it's something that, every individual should be looking into.
1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, Bill Powers, who is the author of Cold, Hungry, and In the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. Do you think it is a myth? Are you worried about our reliance on natural gas? Do you think we should be investing in more natural gas, like natural gas-powered vehicles? What do you think of the production of natural gas in this country, all the shale gas, the fracking that's going on, like in states like Nebraska? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Carl in Madison is with us. Hello, Carl.
Yes, good morning, Joy, and good morning to your guest. My interest in this conversation is to the degree that it puts us toward a sustainable future, and I know that people have talked about natural gas as a bridge fuel that can take us from dirty carbon oil and coal production towards something that is more sustainable, and that's very important if we burnt all the oil and coal that are just in existing reserves held by corporations right now. We would fry our planet well beyond anything that any scientist is suggesting is sustainable for human life. So the use of natural gas as a bridge fuel towards something more sustainable sounds like a good idea, as the author is describing. There may be some real issues with supply, but beyond that, if we just say, oh, natural gas is the new panacea, just 3%, my understanding is, of any kind of leakage of the fuel from the source all the way to wherever it's burned will produce more CO2 in the air than will the use of other carbon fuels. So it clearly is something that can only make a jump in the right direction. And I'm just curious about, somewhat similar to the last questioner, but just really curious about the guest's perspective on how do we get to where we really need to get to go, which is far beyond this conversation about which CO2-based fuel we're going to use, but how do we make the quickest leap towards something that is going to keep this planet alive for future generations?
Well, a couple things. I talk about exactly what the question you just posed in the book, and part of it, what it was, is using natural gas for the maximum benefit of all stakeholders. And this is an idea that I did not come up with. This is in place right now in the Netherlands. The Netherlands has Europe's largest natural gas field. It's the Groningen field that was discovered in the 60s and really came into production in the 70s. And what they have done is capped production from this field, and basically they've set a price floor to hold the field's production, to extend it for as long as possible, so that they don't deplete their resources very quickly. And just to make it clear, I don't believe natural gas is a bridge fuel. I don't believe we have as long a runway as people think using natural gas. And a lot of the investments we're making in natural gas-fired power plants are going to be seen as incredibly wasteful due to the lack of supply that's available. And I'll give you a very good example that I talk about in the book extensively, is the United Kingdom. In the 1980s, there was a huge gas rush that came from the United Kingdom's North Sea fields, and this was used by Margaret Thatcher as well as other politicians to break the back of the coal miners' union. They built hordes of natural gas-fired power plants, and the UK even became an exporter of natural gas between 1998 and 2003. But they have since depleted those fields so rapidly that now they are one of the biggest importers of natural gas in the world. They import almost 70% of all of their natural gas that they consume on a daily basis, and they are really scrambling for ways to mitigate, to reduce their consumption. And I'm not saying that this is exactly the pattern that the U.S. is going to follow, but we should be aware of large ramp ups in consumption, because the supply may not be there. And I have studied this for many years, and it's quite evident from the production history that we see in established shale gas fields that the production is not going to be there in future years. And I think we should start thinking about how do we become sustainable right now, and save the natural gas for emergency only.
Well, so why isn't there more investment in renewable energy?
Well, I think part of it is because electricity prices have been depressed in recent years because it has not been as cost effective. But what we've seen is Germany, which depends on Russia for quite a bit of its natural gas, has made huge investments in solar power. They have a larger solar powered base than anyone in the world, and they get as much sunlight on a daily basis as Seattle, Washington. So they have had a huge incentive to reduce their natural gas consumption because they do not like to depend on Russia for a significant portion of their gas, and for reasons but the U.S. we are installing a lot of wind power. We see that in Wisconsin. We are seeing a lot of solar being installed, especially in the Southwest and in California. So we are making the investments, but I just unfortunately we have not made enough, in my opinion, already to mitigate the coming crisis.
Carolyn Appleton emails, U.S. natural gas companies have been building lots of gas liquefaction plants at our coastal ports. Our natural gas can be piped to these and then condensed and cooled into a liquid, put into refrigerated tankers, and shipped to countries where the price is five times greater. It is worth the cost to get the greater price overseas. So we will have to pay a lot more here in this country because we will be directly competing. Does she have that right?
Well, right now, the U.S., the only place that exports natural gas in LNG form is, it recently closed, was on the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska. But as far as there have been permits issued by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to build LNG export facilities in Louisiana and in Texas. And I discuss this in the book, and it is a profoundly bad idea because, as I mentioned earlier, that one of the facts that no one recognizes is that the U.S. is not self-sufficient in natural gas. We are a net importer of gas, and the majority of our gas comes from Canada. And Canada is within 3 years or so of cutting off all exports to the United States, because they've had falling production since 2001, and they are also building substantial export capacity in British Columbia to export gas to Asia, and they're also seeing record internal domestic demand from both fertilizer plants that are opening as well as the oil sands. So the idea of the U.S. ever being a significant exporter of LNG is just never going to happen.
Let's take a call from Bill in Lancaster. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I think what we need to do is we need to, like you said, spread out the power supplies on the grid. And I think we need to incentivize people, though, to want that. I think the way we pay for electricity now should be changed. It should be based on distance from the source of production of the power and also based on amount of consumption. So if you burn so many kilowatt hours per month, you get paid at this rate, and if you go past that, you pay 50% more for every kilowatt hour past that. And it would really help the wind industry to get moving and get rid of some of these not-in-my-backyarders by basically increasing the cost of electricity right now by 20%, and then anybody who's within a mile in line of sight of a wind turbine gets a 20% reduction in their electricity.
What do you think of that?
I think that's, you know, obviously a very forward-looking idea, and I think there is, you know, some merit to it. You know, but the big roadblock that you're seeing happen to having a distributed power is the incumbent utilities. And if we look at what's happening in California, and I talk about this, is that in the book, is that they put a proposal to ballot. I think it was Proposition 16. This was a few years ago, where that would have required a ballot initiative by communities and a two-thirds majority vote to approve the formation of new energy cooperatives, which are basically power authorities that are owned by residents of a certain town or a small number of towns put together. And what they wanted to stop is these communities from building solar arrays that would serve their residents, and they would be able to set the price of their own power, and they would be able to also sell, the residents would be able to sell excess power into their grid to their neighbors at a price that would be set by these local cooperatives. And the Pacific Gas and Electric spent millions and millions of dollars, and fortunately for the ratepayers of California, this was defeated by some grassroots organizations that spent around $35,000.
Bill Powers, I'm sorry, I've got to jump in because we have less than a minute to go, and I want you to give listeners a takeaway from this conversation from your book. What should we remember?
We should remember that natural gas is not a bridge fuel, that we do not have a 100-year supply, and that a significant rise is coming to this country, and it will shake the foundations of the economy and change the way we think of energy security.
Thank you very much for being with us. Bill Powers is the author of Cold, Hungry, and In the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air direction and to Justin Williams for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, we will take a look at the Wisconsin born conservative movement known as the John Birch Society. That's coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.